Once again, Paul Ebbingkamp, Katie Bohens, let's ask the poets some questions, and they might even have questions for one another. It's always a possibility.
What's your middle name?
Anton.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Cool.
What's yours?
Morgan.
Like
that's Andrew's middle name.
Andrew's, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I never liked Katie. I always reminded me of like a young white girl playing tennis and being like, oh, daddy, toss me another lob. Like, I never liked it.
Better than golf.
Yeah, so, but the saving grace is this Y in my name, K-A-T-Y. Just a little bit better. My self-opinions.
Yes.
If you guys could rename yourselves, what would they be?
Oh, definitely.
Because it was an interesting idea.
Yeah.
If I could rename myself, I would remove all names. I wouldn't rename myself.
That's interesting.
I'll take that answer, but my second answer is... I tried this once, and my dad got really mad. He was like, "You cannot take my name away from like it was like a personal insult to him that I wouldn't carry his terrible Slovenian last name. It's unspellable, unpronounceable." Like, I was like, "All right, Dad, like whatever." But I was gonna go with K, Bell Sphinx, or Beau Sphinx, like just because like in French it means like beautiful mystical creature, and I thought it was like. Really kind of impish and like, I don't know, kind of like, fuck you to the establishment. Like, can you imagine like in New York Review of Books, an article by like, K. Bo Sphinx? I thought that was really funny, sorry.
Names are just too much. But Baudelaire had a thing about his name, which Baudelaire is a kind of shiv or knife, mm-hmm. or it was in the slang, or in some way it was like closely related to the word, particular French word for a type of knife. Yeah. And he just had this thing about like, that's what I am, which is totally stupid. But anyway, my name in German means tie, like in a draw, you know, in a sports match or something.
Even
struggle. So I kind of often think of, you know, I'm working on a truce with all things. I'm an Aquarius.
Outer space.
I have a question for you guys.
Yes.
It's a question that is different for either of you, but it's about names. So, and Katie, in your book, there are obviously so many names. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, the name is Alain. Mm-hmm. But of course, like it's Alain Badiou, but also there seems to be lots of different kinds of fantasies mm-hmm. about the different Alains. So there's Alain the philosopher, but then Alain that's in the bedroom, and mm-hmm. and then there's lots of Katies and Catches and yeah. other people. So I was wondering if you would maybe say something about that. And then Paul, I think as a non-compliment to that question, I mean, it's almost as if. The proper name is, at least in the reading you gave, and the proper name seems to have been really removed. And all those other stuff happens in the syntactical world of the poems, but the proper name doesn't appear, and I could be incorrect about that, but I'm just wondering if you would say something about that, the lack of the name.
Do you want to go first?
Actually, you go first, because I'm still thinking about my answer.
Yeah. Even down to titles, there were several titles that I chose not to read just because, you know, these things. John Ashbery has a great line about titles, and a title is a kind of name. And he said that a title is really like the handle on a briefcase. It's, you know, it's good to have, but it is not, it's part of the structure, but it's not coterminous with the structure, you know, it's a custom for a way to convey things. So you know, I often just, I try as much as possible to de-emphasize that, although the work is very, very allusive. Starting with, you know, the long poem I read is an homage to a band. There is one place name in the book, and it is Lawrence, Kansas. And that's it. So, yeah, it is deliberate to de-emphasize the act of naming in favor of a different kind of process of learning and identification. And a lot of it is obscure. But it's not my hope is that it is not non-referential, but that it is kind of, you know, a lot of times it was a vogue maybe 10 years ago when I started reading poetry, or 15, a vogue to have lots and lots of footnotes. This lyric owes a lot to a Wilco song. You name the song, name the album, and I found that pretty reprehensible. it's part of that. It's really a purposeful de-emphasization.
Yeah. If I could say one other thing, which is that the work doesn't seem antisocial, but it doesn't approach the social of the poem as the way we know it so familiar. You know what I mean?
I do, Brandon. Yeah.
But also, there is a proper name, right? I don't remember if it's Lo B or the Based God, but.
Oh, yeah.
He appears, right?
Yeah, Four Colors for the Based God. That's a poem. James Ferraro, actually, is also named, if anybody knows. I forgot about that one. Yeah, there's a little bit. And, you know, it's just for the joy of homaging the artists that I love and spreading the word.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Actually, this is great that you went first, because you kind of said a lot of, there's actually a page in Dear Ellen where she says, literally the letter is, I hate names, I hate names, I hate names. And the philosophers have written a lot about, the process of naming. And there's, books and, you know, millennia of books of talking about the process of naming. And so I'm kind of critiquing. I'm like, oh, well, Len, you say that you can get around the problem of naming with this thing or another, but I just don't buy it. But underneath that letter is almost everything that so much of what you said, I think, is beautiful and wonderful. But Brandon, you asked about something different, sort of like, but because at the same time, there's also this performativity, right? There's this young person, young poet who's writing to this famous proper name philosopher who she doesn't know. And I think that there is part of the tension of that is, I think she even, I think that the argument may even be explicit at some point of who do you think you are? What right do you have to? Why are you doing this? What is it just to make yourself a name? And where is the truth value in that? And where is, we're all sitting around talking about deep shit. It's like oh well, I can talk about deep shit better than you can. My name's bigger than you. I just is like it's ridiculous to me. But I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay. So, but if you want a really big name, I can tell you how to do it. You just get a multi-million-dollar marketing budget. It's a very simple equation. Yeah. Very one-to-one correspondence. There you go.
You want to do it quick.
Yeah, you just, you could become friends with LeBron James or, Kanye West, and you can get a marketing budget, and then for, AT&T, they have, 17 brand impressions per day per human being in the United States. So literally, if you want to be famous, that is how you do it. You pay to have your brand name put in front of other human beings' eyeballs. It's called impressions. Yeah. So the proper name becomes conflated with the brand name in today's culture, and the brand name is I think has not to do with intimacy, has not to do with the individual, but has to do with capitalism and money. So, if that makes sense.
Hi, my question's for you about like how you started this project and why you decided to use letters as your form of, you know, I'm really interested in, you know,
totally.
How this whole process started, that you started writing letters to this philosopher.
Yeah. And then we sent them to him. Yeah. So when I started, it was totally a joke. I was like flirting with my friend. I was at a bookstore and I bought these Badia books because I was like, I know about philosophy. And he was like, no, you don't. And I was like, yes, I do. Like, it was really like I was kind of trying to impress him. And he was like, well, what are you going to write about tonight? I said, well, maybe I'll write love letters to Badia. And it was a joke. And we laughed. And then I was like, you know, that's actually a really good idea. And part of what I was thinking about is the use of I. And actually, I'm glad I brought that Gao Xingjian, because part of my interest in the use of I is, like, literally the pronoun, like I, and using that, is that I did live in China for a while, and there in the culture, it's impolite to use the word I. So you don't, like, one would never in a social conversation say, oh, I am doing this, like as we are accustomed to doing, because it's something that is from communism. So even on the news, they'll say, we the Chinese people have this opinion. Like, I mean, it's kind of insane. And one of my favorite lines from Gao Xingjian is he says, I only use the word we when I am too weak to use the word I. And so the personal form of the letter to me represents the position of poetry as representing that individual space, representing that intimacy, representing the I. You know, Ariana Rines calls it the eye of poetry. And I think that's very much, that is very literally why it's in that personal address. And it has to be in that form because that's the only true way, I think, that really poetry could represent itself in a discussion with philosophy, which is the universal address, right? So those are in opposition, so. And I think choosing to be a poet rather than a philosopher is largely because a desire to want to represent that personal truth and thinking maybe universal truth is always necessarily flawed. So.
Right on.
Thanks.
Yes.
I feel like philosophy, though, could also be personal, in the sense that you're trying to find your own personal philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they're same, but there's just like different, there's just different roads to the same higher ideal, right?
Yes. I mean, I don't know. I still go back and forth on this, you know? Like, I still have these thoughts. I still, you know, I correspond a little bit with Badia, and I say to him, like, what the hell? Like, why? You know, I still have this. I'm like, maybe the difference between poetry and philosophy is this, you know? It's like, what is the difference? I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes I start to think that you could read my whole book of poems and you wouldn't know me. Like, you wouldn't really truly know me. But in some ways, like, I read enough Badia that, like, I already know him. Like, there is no distance between what he's writing about and how he runs his life. So, whereas with poetry, there's, like, this total fictional element where it's just, you know, I could read everything about Alice Notley and Alice Notley ever wrote, and I wouldn't walk up to her and know her. Like, but you can do that with these philosophers. So that's an interesting, you know, double loop back also. You know, it's kind of counterintuitive. I didn't know that when I started the project.
Mm-hmm. Can I just follow up on that quickly? I think about that a lot. That's a great question. I mean, so regarding the personal versus collective or the personal or universal, I mean, the way I feel about it, from where I sit right now, it seems to me that the personal is an inflection of consciousness and the collective is an inflection of consciousness. You know, these are, it's the same sort of force or energy that, you know, generates these ideas. And we all have so much in common. I mean, it's unbelievable that we're just sitting here and basically understanding the same thing that's happening, and that this all holds together somehow is a really incredible situation. So it's a really interesting problem. The what I feel is what you feel, but not at all in some other profound way. And that, yeah, I think we can, you can sort of talk generally about the forms of life, like birth and death, and need for sustenance, and language, and breathing, and all that. But nobody has the right to say how it is for anybody else. You know, that's a luxury that no one has. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to throw in my own perspective on this, because when I went to college, I was, of course, an English major and or literature student and so forth. And then just a few years ago, I came and audited some philosophy courses here, actually, at State. And it was quite a shock. It was a totally different culture. In the literature departments, people throw out some ideas about what they think, and everybody listens to it and say, oh, you really think that? Hey, that's interesting. I think this, and people go around like that. In the philosophy department, it's not like that at all. Those guys say, no, you're wrong. That's not right. And they prove it to you, and so forth. And so that's what we mean by objectivity, and in fact, saying something for that's other people. It's not just true for me, it's true for you, too, is what they were trying to say. However, I'm still interested in philosophy too. It's I don't know why, actually. I juggle the both.
I know, right? Yeah. Why? There is something there. Like, what is it?
You know. Right.
Well, it kind of seems like there's like a play. Because philosophy really feels like it depends on language to try to grasp at something more formal and like structural, and it almost feels like sometimes it resents having to use language to try to get at these bigger things. Like, language is a problem in its way. It seems like poetry has more of a like idea of play or of like interest in that in and of itself, like the words, not as just like a tool. But I saw that in both your guys, kind of what you're using, you know, is like it felt like your letters were addressed, they were railing against something that was like a wall, something that was more solid, which is sort of the idea of a philosopher who understands. And Paul, yours was like very like at play within language completely, even like down to what Brian was saying about like no names, you know? It was just working, like moving between colors, sound, textures that were very much even just the sounds of the words themselves. So that feels like, I don't know, you guys want to talk about that.
I feel like philosophy is like It's like the jungle gym. It's like the architecture. Like it's the walls, or it's like the description of the walls. And then like your poems, I don't think mine are really, but yours are like it's like what's happening at the horizon. Like the philosophies like want they can only describe it. You did it, you know. Mm. I think. And then I'm just like mad.
Yeah, I do want to say something about that, but I don't know what it is, which is maybe exactly the point of the question. Yeah, I'll come back to that, I think, but that's great. Thank you.
You said that it centers around how mad you got, and don't you think that there's a lot of merit in being mad and how you can write poems by being mad?
Oh, totally. And I mean, I also think one of the things I like about the book is that it's very interested in social language and how you can use that basically kind of like that dimension of language to create a poetry. And to play with that dimension is, I'm performative. I like to do that. It's fun for me. I think it's, you know, fun for people who read it. So.
There's a thing going on, I've noticed, in discussions of political, philosophical things, where
people think, well, if you're mad about it, if you're emotional, then you're less valid in your argument.
Oh, totally. I'm not, and she gets in that fight with him. She's like, there's like a whole section. She's like, oh, I have to put it in a tone for it to be true. Like, don't tell me about tone, buddy. I'm a poet. I know about tone, you know what I mean? It's like, it's like, you know, and part of it is, I mean, it's also like it's very much a feminist thing too. It's like, I'm gonna have these arguments with you and I'm gonna go toe to toe with you and I'm gonna do it in the tone of voice of, you know, of femininity, of, you know, like anger, like it like playing with these tonalities. Like there's that first section has a lot of like little girl voice in it. And I stand behind that 150%. I mean, that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that tonality. And that's part of the argument that's in there. I know that this went over well because when Badia and I had dinner for the first time, he was like, it's such an amazing feminist text. Like, you know, he's like you never even mention feminism, and yet it's so present. It's like it's right there. You go toe to toe. It's really beautiful. And I was like, yes, I won. I won the point.
So
you've
been in a fist fight. Oh
man, he's old. So I feel like that's unfair. Yeah. So she has one with, they're just very short, they're like dates, sort of. And there's one with Julian Assange, and then there's another one with Slavo Žižek. And she's kind of mean to him. Yeah, but he was really a good sport about it. He was really nice when I met him. He was like, oh sure, hi, how are you? He was kind of flirting with me, actually. All the same. Right? It's that Plus. Culture. It's that culture. I don't know. You know this culture.
Is there one more hand, or did I see
some? I was just going to ask, like, when you had dinner with, I mean, when you sent the bulk of your letters to Badu, did you expect him to respond favorably to it right away because you knew?
Well, I did. I was really worried because she breaks up with him at the end of the book. Sorry, that's a spoiler. And I didn't know if he, and also I didn't know if he's going to take it really personally. Like, I wasn't sure. But, yeah, I didn't know for a few months. It wasn't until we had dinner that he was like, yeah, this is my favorite book written about me. He, like, loves it. He's like, oh, it's so good. It's not so boring and academic. It's really, I was like, okay, great. All right. it worked. It was really funny. Brandon was really instrumental in helping me edit the text in the early stages. And I was like, I think actually I was here. We had lunch. And I was like, I think I wrote this book. I think it's like a metaphor for Badia's work. And Brandon was like, I don't know. And I was like, I don't know either. And then I was like, who do we ask? And I was like, well, maybe I have to ask him. Because I don't know that anybody else, like, there's probably like three people, my dad always says there's like three people in the world that understand what the hell this guy's talking about. And I'm one of them. I was like, awesome. That's my great life accomplishment. That's pretty funny. Anyway. Paul, will you say, I have to stop talking?
No, you really don't.
Oh, okay. Can you talk?
Well, let me dweeb out just a second on the question you asked about the, you know, the philosopher versus the poet. And again, those are names that have no corresponding reality. I mean, I guess I feel like in sort of the analytical side of me is that life is a dream and I should really stop dreaming it. You know, that would be good. But the sort of surrealist or artist says something, it's like, yes, but one way to get at that, since we are here and dealing, you know, is to kind of amp up the dream in a way that makes it more palpable or visible, to sort of understand its limitations. And play is a part of that, you know, so that's kind of where I seem to be oscillating, like, between those two. They're not really desires. It's just like these seem like self-evident things that I try to negotiate somehow. And it just happens to be through writing.
And music,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, that, yeah. Music, too. Noise music. Yes?
I just want to mention that, going back to titles, that the cover of Paul's book glows in the dark.
So watch out when you get your 2 a.m. glass of water.
Oh, my God. You won.
Yeah. It's the spine, too, so you got to...
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, that was pretty special.
That's amazing.
Yeah, one last maybe?
Yeah, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I can't remember your name.
Paul.
He doesn't have a name.
No, it's okay.
Paul and or no name. Well, did your poetry book have a main theme to it?
No.
No, it was totally okay.
But I think I cut you off. Okay. You were still asking your question. I'm sorry, I thought I cut you off from your question. Okay. No, there wasn't a theme. There wasn't. I had a chance to put a lot of work out that had been sitting around for a long time. And, you know, once the project comes around, you do start to focus on what it has in common. But it's really pretty baggy, you know, pretty diverse. But there's a lot of visual work that I had been doing for a while that was very vivid, full color. And I never thought it would see the light of day because it's very hard to publish in color. But they offered to do that, so that's, you know, it became really about form and color in a way that, but it wasn't a project that I proposed that I was working on for a while. It was the convenience arose of publication, so I kind of, yeah. Yes?
How do you decide what poems to type and what poems to like hand?
That's a great question. I got tired about 5 or 6 years ago. I got tired of verse just being, every poem's got one good line, but they're usually not all good lines. And I got kind of bored and frustrated with having to stick with this. It's got to be a lot of lines. And I eventually just decided to decimate my body of work and take only the good lines, only the lines that really spoke to me, and developed this somatic practice where I was working through them and writing them repeatedly over many, many months and developing a style of handwriting and just wanting to focus on the good stuff, you know, because there was an economic argument to that, to be honest, because it's hard to get noticed. It is. And so this was one way of really loudly putting stuff out and just saying, kind of, screw the poem, you know? Yeah, it was part of that. I had a job with the scanner. Anyway, that's not really what you want to hear. It was a very deliberate thing, what I really needed to find a new way to write.
I think it's great.
If you had to give us an assignment that could be undertaken in the next 5 days, what might that assignment be?
Oh, gosh.
A writing assignment.
A writing assignment? Can it be a reading experiment? I would read Bernadette Mayer's Experiments. And then I would take one of her ideas and write from it. And that's like, I don't know, most people here, I don't know if you love poetry or you don't love poetry or you're writers or whatever, but that's a must have. You must read Bernadette Mayer's Experiments. And the other thing that I think is cool is to try to write poems that are inspired by your favorite rapper. Right? I want to see more rap.
Like, if you're your own favorite rapper.
My favorite rapper is Gil Scott-Heron. You knew it. Oh my God, he's in that book. He's like in, like, there's all these allusions to him, and no one's ever picked up on that before, so we're Steve knew. It was great. Yeah.
The closest thing I have to Reason, that's where
I yes, it's like, yeah. Yes, yeah, it's on his new album. I don't know if you know Gil Scott-Heron, he passed away, unfortunately, but he's like, people say he's like the Black Bob Dylan. He started a whole bunch of stuff, and like Kanye West samples him and Common, and like he did like he's a huge influence, and his work is amazing. He just has so much soul. Like you hear him and you're just like, oh my god, like it's there's something in it. It kills me every time. Anyway, I'll
That's
stop
good.
Proselytizing.
That's a great assignment.
Yeah.
I guess mine would be just pretty simple. Just write with something other than what you're used to in terms of the actual physical implement or utensil. Like if you always use a computer, don't use a computer for a week. Or if you always use a pink crayon, don't use a pink crayon for a week.
There's a big piece of pink chalk over there.
That's a good one. That's great. That's kind of phallic.
It is.
But yeah, you know, just jam. Just pick some new implement.
So you should all write with your vibrators.
But then it can be, you know, a huge thing if you're just suddenly not using what you're used to using.
There you go.
And if you have access to a vibrator. Yeah.
I'd like to see what the letters would look like.
Right. It got worse. The metaphor got worse. I'm going to stop before I say it.
Well, thank you both very much. You've been very generous.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you all.